Hello and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and Jimmy Akin joins us this time for a conversation about when the early church knew that Jesus was God. This is something that is a matter of a great deal of controversy and academic work, trying to figure out exactly when this idea developed. Was it late in the formation of Christianity, late in the first century, early second century? Was it earlier than that? Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy.
Hello, Cy Kellett.
So Bart Ehrman has materials called How Jesus Became God.
And he has a book.
A book,
Form the Materials Take, yeah.
Yeah, well, but he also did a video and other things about it. It's a good question in this sense. It's really the modern question about Jesus and the kind of the modern story, or one modern story, because there's many. There's this charismatic figure, Jesus. Maybe he's accessible to us historically a little bit, but maybe not. Probably an apocalyptic teacher executed, just like many figures of that time were, who would have been a charismatic, maybe messianic type figures. After his death, stories about him develop, that he'd risen from the dead. And over time, a community began to worship him as God. Is that just a made-up story, or is that related to history at all?
Well, it's going to depend on the way that you articulate this. The recognition that Jesus was God is something that people did not have from the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know, people, when they saw him walking down the street, did not think, oh, that must be God.
Yeah.
And so there was a process by which people came to learn that he was God. And we wouldn't want to dismiss that fact and claim mm-hmm. that there was no process involved. On the other hand, the idea that this is something that emerged late in this, like in the second century or after the ministry of Jesus, is just not supported by the evidence.
Okay.
The evidence we have is found in the documents of the New Testament, which are among the earliest Christian documents. We have a few Christian documents that are as old as some of the writings of the New Testament, but the New Testament documents were those that were recognized as authoritative for Christian faith, and there's a reason that they were acknowledged that way. There had been a tradition in the churches of these documents being passed down as authoritative for faith from the beginning. That's why they were accepted. And other later documents didn't have the same authority. Also, the New Testament documents were recognized as expressing the faith that had been taught by the apostles. In fact, many of the New Testament documents were written either by apostles or they were written by close associates of apostles. And so we can have a lot of confidence that these documents accurately convey the message that the apostles were preaching about Jesus, which is the earliest message we have. Since Jesus didn't write anything himself, we have to rely on those who knew him and those who were authorized as teachers by him. And as these are the people who are going to teach my message. And when we do that, when we look at the New Testament documents, we find that they contain what's often called a high Christology. That is one that a doctrine of Christ, that's what Christology is. And it's described as a high Christology because it recognizes Jesus as having a very high position that identifies him with God, as opposed to, for example, simply a man, which would be a low Christology, or an angel or something like that, which you could maybe say would be a middle Christology. But if you look at the writings, for example, of St. Paul, which are often considered the earliest writings that we have that are Christian, although that's not really true, the Gospels were written at the same time effectively as most of Paul's epistles. And so if you date them the way I do. And so I don't think Paul's are the earliest, but if you look in his epistles, he flatly calls Jesus God. He refers to him as our God and Savior, Jesus Christ. And so you have explicit declarations from St. Paul that Jesus is God. And St. Paul was recognized as a legitimate apostle by the other apostles. You know, he talks about, for example, in Galatians, how Peter, James, and John, the so-called pillars of the Jerusalem church, gave him the right hand of fellowship and acknowledged the legitimacy of his message. So if he's calling Jesus God and they're acknowledging his message and giving him the right hand of fellowship, that would indicate that they also believed in Jesus as God. And we see evidence of that in the writings that are associated with Peter and John. Now, James died very early. He was martyred by Herod Agrippa II about AD 49. And I'm sorry, AD 43. And so he was dead within a decade of when Jesus was crucified. And so James, son of Zebedee, didn't leave us any writing. The so-called epistle of James is written by a different James known as James the Brother of the Lord or James the Just. But Peter's preaching was preserved in the form of the Gospel of Mark. And if you look in the Gospel of Mark, there is a scene where Jesus is having a confrontation with the high priest. This is the first of his trials. And at the trial, they have a bunch of witnesses, which Mark says are false witnesses, and their testimony doesn't even agree with each other. And at one point, the high priest he's getting frustrated, and he says, don't you have anything to say to these people who are accusing you? And Jesus just remains silent. And so the high priest then asks what he really wants to know, which is, tell us plainly, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed, meaning the Son of God? Now, the term Son of God can be understood different ways. In the Old Testament, the term Son of God gets used to refer sometimes to high angelic beings who are called the sons of God, for example, in the book of Job, and we see them operating up in heaven. It's also used for righteous people. You know, the righteous man calls God his father and so forth. But it can also be used in other ways. And in the centuries leading up to the time of Christ, there what's known as the Second Temple period, because Solomon's temple was the first temple, but it had been destroyed, so they built a new one, and that's why this is called the Second Temple period. There was a literature that developed in Jewish circles that talked about another kind of Son of God, who also it gets referred to, interestingly, as the Son of Man. Now, the term Son of Man can just mean a human being. So, for example, if you read the book of Ezekiel, when God is talking to Ezekiel, he refers to Ezekiel as Son of Man, and it just means a human being. But there's another figure known as the Son of Man in Second Temple literature, such as, for example, in the book of First Enoch, which is not part of the Bible, at least not most Christian Bibles, but it was written between different parts of it were written between 100 and 200 years before the time of Christ. So this concept of the celestial Son of Man was already out there, and it has its roots in Old Testament prophecy, in the book of Daniel specifically. There's a moment where Daniel sees a vision, and the book of Daniel deals with the rise and falls of various kingdoms, like the Babylonian Empire, the Macedonian Empire under Alexander the Great, and so forth. And he sees this line of kingdoms that are rising and falling, and then he sees a new kingdom, which is depicted as a stone that is cut without hands. And without hands means God did it. You know, this is not the action of human beings. This is something that has been done by heaven. And so he sees this new kingdom pictured as a stone that grows and grows and fills the entire earth. And so this is in line with Jewish messianic expectations of a coming messianic kingdom that God brings about. And Daniel also sees a vision of God in heaven with thrones, and God sits on one of the thrones, and other heavenly figures sit on the other thrones. And then a figure that Daniel describes as like a Son of Man comes before God with the clouds of heaven. And he's not coming from the earth. He seems to be a celestial being who is presented before God in heaven and also therefore shares, you know, divine authority. Now, this is one passage from the Old Testament. There are others that led to a kind of pre-Trinitarian belief in Second Temple Judaism. There are other passages, for example, that that depict the angel of the Lord coming to people, but then it will speak as if the angel is the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for example, at the sacrifice of Isaac in Genesis, the angel of the Lord, you know, speaks to Abraham and tells him not to kill his son Isaac. And then God starts talking to Abraham, and it's like the angel is God somehow.
Yeah,
and Jewish sages wondered about these kind of passages, and they eventually developed what's now called, this is a modern term, but it's called the two powers in heaven doctrine. And the idea is that in addition to Yahweh, there's this other power in heaven who's like a little Yahweh. He's sometimes called the second Yahweh. And so this is a sort of pre-Trinitarian belief in a duality or multiplicity within the Godhead. And this was eventually, after the rise of Christianity, in rabbinic Judaism, this was declared heretical. But it was a live option for Jews at the time of Christ. So mm-hmm. when we go to Jesus's confrontation with the high priest, and the high priest says, "Tell us plainly who you are. Are you the Son of God?" Jesus in Mark says, "I am, and henceforth you will see the Son of Man seated on the clouds of heaven," or coming with the clouds of heaven. And that statement about the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven is echoed in both Matthew and Luke when they recount this incident. And so what Jesus is referring to there is the prophecy in Daniel mm-hmm. about the celestial heavenly Messiah or Son of Man, the second power in heaven, the little Yahweh or the second Yahweh. He's saying, "I'm that guy." And it's at that point the high priest tears his clothes and accuses Jesus of blasphemy. Now, that means the high priest recognized exactly what Jesus was claiming, that he was claiming to be this second divine figure.
Because that blasphemes God, in other words.
Correct.
It's not blasphemy to claim to be Messiah.
That's the point I was going to make. Yeah. They were expecting a Messiah.
Yeah,
It's not blasphemy to say you're the Messiah, but to say you're the second power in heaven alongside Yahweh, that you could consider blasphemy.
Gotcha.
And so that's what sets the high priest off. Now, some people like Bart Ehrman acknowledge that there is this celestial son of man figure in Second Temple literature, but for some reason, and I've talked to Bart about this briefly, you know, he wants to say, but Jesus didn't claim to be him. Jesus thought the Son of Man was somebody else who was going to come. And the only way you can do that is if you cherry pick the data, because all three of the synoptic gospels present Jesus claiming to be the Son of Man, the celestial Son of Man. And so you're dismissing the evidence that we have if you say, "Oh, but he's not actually claiming this." You read these passages in context, and yes, he is claiming to be a divine figure. And this has been recognized by the scholars who've actually done a lot of work in this area. Bart really hasn't done a lot of work on the mm-hmm. Son of Man concept. He's reading other people and adopting their ideas, but he hasn't done a lot of personal work on New Testament Christology. Other figures like Larry Hurtado and the British scholar Richard Baucom have done a lot of work in this area, and they've written books that are, you know, part of current scholarship that acknowledge that if you draw a line between the divine and the human, in the views of the New Testament writers, Jesus is on the divine side of that line.
Yeah.
And they also were the people who were most closely connected with Jesus. They were either his immediate disciples or associates of his disciples or otherwise approved teachers like St. Paul. And so we see a broad recognition among Jesus's core followers that he is a divine being. Now, they didn't use the language of the Trinity because it took time for that language to develop.
Right.
But they recognize Jesus is divine. He's not just a man. He's not just adopted by God. He pre-existed. John makes that point. So does Paul. They talk about how Jesus came down from heaven and was incarnate as a man. So that means he pre-existed in heaven before he came here. He wasn't just adopted by God at his baptism like some early heretics claimed. And so we see Jesus's followers, closest followers, having a recognition that he's divine. Now, that doesn't mean there weren't other viewpoints. Some people regarded Jesus just as a human prophet. You know, we see that in the Gospels where Jesus gets hailed as the prophet of Nazareth.
Yeah.
And people don't really realize he's also divine because he's keeping that on the down low. You know, he doesn't mm-hmm. want to get prematurely crucified for blasphemy.
Right.
So he holds that tight until, fairly tight, until he's ready to be martyred. So there were alternative views of who Jesus was. You did have some early Christians or people, I'm using the term Christian broadly, who thought Jesus was just a Messiah. He was just a human Messiah. He wasn't the Son of God. He wasn't the Son of Man in this special celestial sense. You had others known as adoptionists who said, okay, Jesus was adopted as the Son of God at his baptism when God says, this is my beloved son, and they'll interpret that as an act of adoption, which it doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. If he came down from heaven, he was already God's son in heaven, and that's just God announcing it. He's not adopting him.
Right, right.
There were others who said Jesus did come down from heaven, and he really was God, and only appeared to be a man. And the in Greek, the word for to appear is dokein. So these people were known as the docetists because they said Jesus only seemed to be a man. So these are the seemers, the docetists. So you did have different views in early Christianity with people veering off in different directions, either in the human direction or the divine direction. But what we see in the writings of the New Testament is a balance that acknowledges that Jesus is a pre-existent divine being who took on human form, but also he really did take on human form. He took on flesh, and he was born, and he lived, and he died, and he could also, because of his human nature, be described as a man.
Yes.
So we see the New Testament position articulating the view that Jesus is both God and man, and that's something that we can document from the AD 50s and 60s. Which is when the books of the New Testament were written. Paul started writing about AD 50, maybe a couple years before that, but practically safely we can say about AD 50. He died in AD 67. It looks to me, based on a careful reading of the evidence, that the Gospels were written between about AD 55 and AD 65 over the period of about a decade. And so this is within 20 to 30 years after the crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very early. But not only can we document it in literary form from very early times, we have to take into account the fact that these documents didn't come out of nowhere. They were written by people who had been Christians for 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
And so the actual origin of the teaching that Jesus is both God and man is something that goes back to the ministry of Jesus. It is not something that was invented later. And so even though not everybody recognized that Jesus was God and not everybody understood his dual nature correctly, he taught that he was both God and man, and his core disciples who were behind the writing of the New Testament, either directly or through their own disciples, acknowledged that fact. And there's no reasonable reason to doubt that, as scholars like Hurtado and Baucom have documented.
So when we talk about what actually happened then, if you think about, say, Peter, for example, clearly there has to come a time where after Peter meets Jesus,
mm-hmm.
at some point after that, the realization comes that he's more than a man. And so who knows? I mean, any person who comes to know Christ as God, there has to be a process to coming to that. I mean, some, right. for some, the process might be almost apparently instantaneous, but that's kind of miraculous. So the point at which Peter, for example, understands that Christ is God, whether he had a Trinitarian view or not, but understands that this is God, this is not just a man. You would say that Peter comes to that before Christ is even crucified.
Well, within Christ, the period of Christ's ministry. Now, okay. we have documentation of Peter prior to the crucifixion, making his famous confession, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God."
Right.
So he definitely recognized that Jesus was the Messiah during pre-crucifixion. And he also recognized that Jesus was the Son of God pre-crucifixion. The question would be, what did he mean by right. Son of God? Did he have a human understanding of that phrase at the time, an angelic understanding of that phrase at the time, or a divine understanding of the phrase at the time? And that's a little more debatable. So I don't want to overstate the evidence, but certainly by the time that Jesus ascends back to heaven, Peter knows that Jesus is God.
Yeah.
And so Peter came to that realization between AD 29 and AD 33.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly when in that Peter first realized it is harder to say, but he clearly comes to that understanding through his interactions with Jesus.
So maybe a little bit of a side question, but I'm curious about this. Mm-hmm. When we talk about the terminology, there's various kind of titles that they assign to Jesus. And one that you have not mentioned, and I'd like to know what it would have meant when they said it, was Lord. What does it mean when they call him Lord? I'll just let you take that. Yeah.
So the Aramaic term for Lord is Mar. And if you want to say our Lord, you say Maran, or my Lord, Mari. And the term Mar gets used a bunch of different ways in Aramaic. For example, it's used today for bishops.
Okay.
So if you greet, let's say, a Chaldean bishop, let's say his name is Yusuf, you would refer to him as Mar Yusuf, Lord Joseph. And that's how you address a bishop in the Chaldean rite, which uses Aramaic as its liturgical language. Mar had thus has today a broad range of meanings, and it did in Jesus's day too. It's essentially the first century Aramaic equivalent of Mister, and Mister itself is a term. It's just an English repronunciation of Master.
Mm-hmm.
And Lord and Master mean basically the same thing. They can be used in multiple ways. They're used sometimes just as a title of respect and as a recognition of someone's authority. But because God has the supreme authority and is worthy of supreme respect, they also can be used for God. And thus, they're appropriate to use in a divine setting. In fact, in the centuries just before the time of Christ, the Jewish people broadly began to avoid using the name Yahweh because they didn't want to profane it accidentally.
Yeah, you know, okay.
One of the Ten Commandments is don't misuse the name of the Lord. And so it's like, oh, how can we avoid misusing it? I know, let's not use it at all.
Yeah,
right. We'll be safe that way.
Yeah.
And so they would use Mar in Aramaic as a substitute for the name Yahweh. And they would similarly, in Greek, if they were Greek-speaking Jews, would use the Greek equivalent, which is Kurios. And so if you read the Greek New Testament, Jesus is referred to as Kurios, as Lord. But one of the interesting things you see as a result of this is if you look, so there are various passages in the Old Testament that were written before the taboo on using Yahweh came into force. So you'll have psalms that say things like, Yahweh said to my Lord, sit at my right hand, and so forth.
Yeah, right.
But since they wouldn't use the word Yahweh when they would read those, they would replace it in the Greek Old Testament with kurios. So it would say things like, kurios said to my kurios, sit at my right hand.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things you can do is when you come across a quotation of the Old Testament in the New Testament, and the New Testament's written in Greek, so it uses kurios, what you can do is say, okay, here we have a passage from the Old Testament. It's talking about Jesus. It's using the word kurios for him. Let's look up the original Hebrew to this quotation. What's the word there? And when you do that, you sometimes find that the word in the original Hebrew is Yahweh. And so the New Testament, via its quotations of the Old Testament, applies the name Yahweh to Jesus. That's another affirmation that he's Lord in a unique and divine sense, not just in a human sense.
Okay. So I want to ask you about the apostles' earliest preaching then. It seems to me that the at the center of that preaching ministry is the synagogue, mm-hmm. that they go to the synagogue. I want to ask you if you can—
And public squares and things like that, too.
Okay, all right.
Synagogue, sure.
But so as they go out into the world and they're proposing the gospel to people, what is it that they're asking people to accept? Are they saying, the Messiah that we've been expecting has come, accept him as the Messiah? Or are they saying that this Jesus was Messiah and Lord and the Son of God and accept him as that? Do you see what I'm saying? Is the earliest,
yeah.
If you could reconstruct it, what would it look like, do you think?
Well, it would involve all of those.
Okay.
They wanted people to accept Jesus as Messiah, and specifically wanted people to accept him as the divine Messiah.
Okay.
Because like I mentioned in Daniel, there is this divine Messiah tradition mm-hmm. that is further elaborated in other Second Temple documents like First Enoch. And so that's part of what they're preaching. They do want Jesus recognized as a divine figure, and that's indicated, for example, by some of the earliest non-Christian references we have to what Christians do. Around the year 120, there was a Roman figure named Pliny the Younger. He's different than his uncle, Pliny the Elder. Pliny the Elder was a fascinating guy. He was a Roman who was basically a scientist, or what they called a natural philosopher at the time, and he wrote a series of books about proto-scientific phenomena as they understood it. Pliny the Elder was a really curious guy, and he was so curious, curiosity killed the cat. When Vesuvius blew up in AD 79, he was curious. He wanted to study a volcanic eruption up close. And he got too close, and he became overcome by fumes and died.
Pliny the Former.
Yeah. So his nephew, Pliny the Younger,
yeah.
ends up becoming governor of Bithynia, which is in modern Turkey. And he fancied himself a literary man and an epistolary man. He would write letters to people, and we have a collection of his letters today. And he's also a little bit of a suck-up. And so he would write to the emperor at the time, Trajan, about all kinds of stuff to get the emperor's advice about what to do. And then he'd have this letter, look at what the emperor just told me.
Oh.
And so he's always writing to the emperor and other notables. And in one of his letters, he writes to the emperor about Christians. And because he's had a list, someone came to him and anonymously presented, without revealing who they were, presented a list of people and said, the following individuals are all Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, on the books, there were laws at the time, or legal precedents that had been set for prosecuting Christians. Those date back, you know, or really they were kind of firmed up during the reign of Nero, who after the Great Fire of Rome, used Christians as scapegoats. He claimed Christians deliberately set fire to Rome to deflect rumors that he was the one who set fire to Rome because he wanted to rebuild it in his own image. He had a big architectural plan and he wanted to clear space for it so he could put his plan into effect. That was the rumor. And so he blamed Christians and started an organized persecution of them. And that persecution sort of became a dead letter when Nero committed suicide, but it periodically came back.
Mm-hmm.
And so the persecution would come back into force. And so Pliny, in around 120, I want to say 112. It's one of those two. Anyway, Pliny is wondering what to do about this list and that he's been given. And so he did some investigation. He talked to various people, and some of them said, oh, yeah, I'm a Christian. And others said, well, I used to be Christian, but that was 20 years ago. And he talked to some deaconesses in the church and in his area. And he said that the Christian movement had been growing to the point that the idol makers were having a hard time making ends meet, and mm-hmm. that there were very few sacrifices being offered to the pagan gods in the local temples. So he wasn't sure what to do about these Christians. And in the course of writing the emperor, he describes their worship services as they relate it, because he's never been to one. But he talked to Christians and says, so what is it y'all do? And then they would describe, and they would say, well, we do eat food at our communal gatherings, but it's totally innocent. We're not literally eating babies like the rumors say.
Mm-hmm.
And so they described a worship service to him, and he repeats what they said to the emperor. And among the things that he relates is that the Christians sang a hymn to Christ as a god. And so we have a recognition, either even by non-Christians, that one of the things these early Christians are doing is worshiping Jesus as a god. So that was definitely part of the message.
Yeah, right. And this is a well-developed community that clearly is this, you don't just suddenly start worshiping Jesus as God in 112 or whatnot.
Yeah.
So yeah. So it seems to me that the takeaway from this is you'd say the apostles, by the time Jesus ascended, they know that he is divine, that he is a divine mm-hmm. person, not a human person.
Yeah.
But that doesn't exclude or preclude the idea that there's a kind of, that there can be a theological development, and there can be a development of understanding of what that means. So we shouldn't just be too quick to say, oh, there's no development. They had a perfectly formed Trinitarian theology from the day Jesus rose. But it's also, we also should not say, well, that means you start with low Christology and move kind of slowly over time as the stories get exaggerated or changed to a high Christology. It's a high Christology that needs development.
And there's nothing surprising about that. There have been loads of people. I mean, even if you don't, let's say you're a skeptic like Bart Ehrman, you're not a Christian, you don't believe the Christian truth claims, there's nothing at all implausible about people claiming to be God. There have been loads of people who claim to be God. In Egypt, it was a tradition to worship the Pharaoh as a god,
right.
Specifically to worship the Pharaoh as a manifestation, depending on his phase of life, as Horus or Osiris or things like that. Alexander the Great wanted his soldiers, his forces, to worship him as a god. So you have, I mean, even Charles Manson in the 1960s, okay, he starts the Manson family and he wants them to worship him as a god. And Nero and Caligula wanted to be worshipped as gods. So there's nothing at all implausible about someone claiming in their own lifetime to be God and wanting people to worship them. That actually happens a lot. And so it's not at all, even on a secular view, implausible that Jesus would make the same claim in founding his religious community. It's striking that he would do so in a Jewish context, given Jewish monotheism. But as we said, Second Temple Judaism already had this second power in heaven doctrine that was there, and he was simply claiming to be the second power in heaven. What Jesus did, unlike Pharaoh and unlike Alexander the Great and unlike Caligula and Nero and unlike Charles Manson, was he actually rose from the dead to prove it. So we have actual evidence that that divine claim is true, whereas we don't have such good evidence for the others.
No, right. And Charles Manson killed Sharon Tate, so. Well, he didn't do it directly, but that would seem to suggest a non-divine origin for Charles Manson.
He certainly wasn't loving his neighbors.
No, he certainly wasn't. Jimmy, I really appreciate this. It's very, very helpful. Thank you for taking the time to do it with us.
No problem.
Thanks to our listeners as well. Remember, you can always communicate with us if you'd like. Send us an email. focus@catholic.com is our email address. Maybe you've got an idea for a future episode. Maybe this one sparked a question or an idea for you. Send that to focus@catholic.com. If you'd like to support us financially, you can always do so by going to givecatholic.com. It does take a few dollars to keep the lights on and the cameras going, and your support is always very, very welcome. givecatholic.com. Wherever you're listening to this podcast, if you'd give us those 5 stars and maybe a few nice words, that also helps to grow the podcast. And we want to grow the podcast. We'd like more people to hear conversations like this. Maybe you do too. And we'd really appreciate the 5 stars and a few nice words. That does it for us. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.